Welcome to the 55th episode of the Reading and Writing Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Rutherford. Stay tuned for my interview with Norb Vonnegut, author of the financial thrillers Top Producer and The Gods of Greenwich. Well, welcome back to the Reading and Writing Podcast. My guest today is Norb Vonnegut, author of the new financial thriller The Gods of Greenwich, available in bookstores now. The New York Times recently listed The Gods of Greenwich as a beach read for 2011. Vonnegut's previous novel, also a financial thriller, is Top Producer. Norb, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Jeff. It's great to be here.
Great. Well, I just mentioned your new novel, Gods of Greenwich. If someone hasn't heard about it yet, can you tell them about your new book?
Sure. Well, if you like thrillers, you'll probably gravitate toward Rachel Whittier in The Gods of Greenwich. She could be adorable. She's a nurse. She's pretty. She's 28 or thereabouts. She works on Park Avenue in a plastic surgeon's office. And I would, like I say, she could be adorable except for one thing. At night, she doubles as an assassin, and she runs around the book whacking men and women in their 70s. And so a reader will ask, what does she have to do with a hedge fund in Greenwich? And what does she have to do with a really nasty bank in Iceland? And why in the heck is she killing these 70-year-olds? So I tell the story through the eyes of Jimmy Cusack. He's a guy I think that readers can all root for. He's, he's a young guy. He has a story that we all understand all too well since 2008. The book starts with the four scariest words in finance: I want my money. And so Jimmy Cusack's lead investor pulls out his money from Cusack's hedge fund, and shortly thereafter, everything goes bad for Cusack. He falls behind in his mortgage 3 months, as a matter of fact, and the bank forecloses on him the day that he learns his wife is 2 months pregnant. So he really needs a job. I think that's a story we can all understand post-2008. And so he takes his position with the hedge fund in Greenwich, and he thinks that life is good again. You know, the cash flow is going. But what he realizes is that he's stepped into this Bermuda Triangle of finance. There's his employer, who is an interesting situation in and of itself. There's this nasty bank in Iceland. And like I say, there's this woman, Rachel Whittier, who runs around the pages whacking 70-year-olds.
Great. That's a great description. I've been enjoying the book a lot. And obviously from reading it, you're obviously very familiar with the setting of Greenwich, Connecticut, and the hedge funds that operate from Greenwich. I was curious, what is your background before you started writing financial thrillers?
Well, I worked on Wall Street for 20 years. I graduated from Harvard Business School in 86, and a few years after, started with Kidder Peabody, and later, like so many other people in finance, changed shops several times. So I worked for Kidder. It blew up and turned into Payne Webber. I worked for Morgan Stanley, and finally I stopped where I ended my career in finance with a boutique called Silvercrest Asset Management, where I was a managing director. But I write full-time now, and I'm really having a blast telling stories. And when a buddy of mine in Hollywood asked me to describe The Gods of Greenwich, I told him, what if Tony Soprano ran a hedge fund? Pretty good, right?
Yeah, very. well, when you worked in finance those years, were you writing fiction in your spare time? And if you were, were you thinking, I'm going to write about these characters and setting one day? What's the process been like for you?
Well, there are some who would say that everything that comes out of Wall Street is fiction, but that's another story, I guess. No, the bottom line is that I've been telling stories all my life. I told stories as a kid at the dinner table. And while I was working on Wall Street, I told stories to my clients. Frankly, it was a great way to build business. And I have a million of them. And I've got to tell you, I've got enough material to write for the next 50 years, because working on the street was like living a soap opera 24/7. Give you a great example of this. In Top Producer, which was my first novel, I spliced in a lot of anecdotes from my time as a stockbroker. And there was this one about a broker who had some clients in from out of town, and they worked behind closed doors all day, and reviewed statements, talked about investment strategies, and what have you. And at the end of the day, the stockbroker took his clients out to dinner. They had a bottle of red wine, you know, a nice meal. And the clients decided that they wanted to go to a strip bar. Mm-hmm. And so the broker said, oh, my gosh, you know, because that's a real problem these days in finance. I mean, you really get burns. But he went anyway. And so he went with the clients, and he walked into this strip bar. And the woman on stage who was dancing took one look, covered up with her arms, screamed and ran off the stage. And there were bouncers everywhere. They came screaming out of the woodwork. And three of these really big, burly guys pushed the stockbroker and his two clients out the door and started screaming, "What did you say? What did you do?" You know, these guys all thought they would be beaten up. And the stockbroker said, "That woman on stage, she was my nanny." And you know, I think stories like that deserve a place in fiction. But as a practical matter, and in the answer to your question, Jeff, I never wrote fiction while I was working for Morgan Stanley or Silvercrest or any of the other firms. What I would say is that I used to write investment letters to our clients.
Mm-hmm.
We had discretion over the portfolios, which meant that we could make buy and sell decisions on some portfolios without the permission of clients each time. So if we were to buy IBM or to sell IBM, we would send a letter out to our clients with every trade explaining the rationale. And those things, as you can imagine, they can be pretty dry. There's a lot of writing from Wall Street it's the next best thing to Somnex. But I used to hear from my clients. They'd say, "Norb, oh man, you should really write." And so I did. I started telling the story. And when I was working at Morgan Stanley, I would get up at 5 in the morning and write until 7, then I'd go to work, and I'd write after I came home and on the weekends. And my wife used to call me a hermit with a laptop because I was telling that story all the time in my spare time.
And did that become Top Producer?
And that became Top Producer, yes, thank you.
And do you remember, was there any kind of classic light bulb moment for you when you decided to turn from writing these investment letters to giving it a try to writing a novel? Or was it just something that just kind of happened gradually?
Oh, I think it was more evolutionary than revolutionary. Like I say, I've been telling stories all my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's one I could tell you about my mother's world-famous shrimp, which has nothing to do with finance. Or I could tell you about the time one of the bosses at Morgan Stanley bit off his subordinate's ear. I mean, there are just any number of stories that I've been telling. And writing just seemed like something I had to do. You know, I think as you grow older, you want to do the things that you want to do. And I like writing, I like telling stories, and so turning myself into an author just seemed like the next logical step.
Great. Well, sometimes financial topics, as you know from your years working on Wall Street, can be arcane for the lack of a better word, a mass audience. In writing Top Producer and The Gods of Greenwich, was that something that you thought about or ever found yourself grappling with how to kind of explain the backdrop and some of the machinations behind the financial details so that it would be understandable for a commercial thriller?
Oh, you bet. Let me clue you in on a little secret, Jeff. I hate numbers. I don't care for them at all. And the securities, I mean, come on, nobody wants to read a thriller about securities. I mean, that stuff can be worse than fingernails against a chalkboard. So in The Gods of Greenwich, I really focus on relationships. And I'll give you a couple of examples. My favorite character in the book is a woman by the name of Bianca Leeser. She's not the primary character, but, you know, she's a close second. And I really have a lot of fun building in her backstory. You know, if I could have lunch with anybody in the world, living or dead, it would probably be Dorothy Parker, because I think she was the sharpest wit that ever breathed, you know, that was ever part of mankind. Sure. And the thing I've done with Bianca Leeser is I've built my personal love for Dorothy Parker into Bianca's backstory. So she is a retired romance bestseller. She's given up her career as an author to support her husband, who runs this hedge fund that's never lost money. And Bianca runs around the book quoting Dorothy Parker, which gives me a chance to sort of quote some of my favorite things that Dorothy Parker ever said. Among them, I like a martini to it the most. After three, I'm under the table. After four, I'm under my host. you see what I mean? It has nothing to do with finance whatsoever.
Sure.
I also talk about a condition called prosopagnosia, which some of my cousins have. That's face blindness. That's the literal meaning for prosopagnosia. And if you have face blindness, you can have a conversation around the dinner table. You can talk to your friends, you can talk to people, but the next day, you won't recognize their faces. You'll remember the conversation, you'll remember everything that went back and forth, but you can't identify somebody on the street by virtue of their face. Again, prosopagnosia has nothing to do with some of the arcane instruments that you see in Wall Street, like CDOs and the stuff that people talk about.
I'm curious, I mean, given the backdrop of the novel, and I'm sure you're personally familiar with that Metro North train that goes from Grand Central to Greenwich, and you know, the characters who ride that each day, do you have any sense of your readership, and has it kind of struck a nerve with the people who are working day to day in this setting?
You know, that's a great question, Jeff. The readership varies. So far, when I hear from readers, it's both men and women, okay? And what typically I hear is things like, you know, I love the book, or I didn't like this, but I love this, this was a problem for me, what have you. There's very little description or little discussion of the finance or people approaching it, approaching The Gods of Greenwich with a finance background. You know, I've talked to, sure, I have lots of friends in the industry, and they've read the book, and they think it nails the feeling of working in finance in a hedge fund. But, you know, That said, I hear from all kinds of people, and you know, there's no one emphasis, or there's no backlash, if you will, from the finance industry, because I'm writing about them. I'm not sure I answered your question.
That's okay. Well, with your last name, I think if someone's listening to this podcast, I'm sure they would be curious. So I think I'd be remiss in not asking your relationship with Kurt Vonnegut. He was a cousin, correct?
Yeah, fourth cousin. Not part of my childhood, but I met him as an adult starting my junior year in college. He's a great guy, a source of inspiration in many, many ways. Some that you might guess as a writer, and some that you wouldn't necessarily guess. I'll give you a great example. One thing about Kurt is, had he not been a great writer, I think he would have made a terrific bond salesman. Although I had this discussion with his son, and Mark disagrees. The thing that I remember, though, is that he was always pushing something. He always had a product to sell. He's a really good salesperson, which is why I say that he could have been a bond guy. You know, when my wife and I got married between years at Harvard Business School, we invited him to our wedding, and he sent back this very funny letter, which we have to this day. And he typed it up with an old typewriter, you know, flying K's and dropping L's. And he said, no, I can't come. Sorry about that. And there's just one thing I want you to know. And it may be a little premature, so forgive me. But my son lives in the area. And if you ever have a need, he's a pediatrician. It was just classic Kurt. So yeah, like I say, fourth cousin.
That's great. Well, given your experience thus far with Top Producer and Gods of Greenwich, do you have any tips if you're speaking to someone who's an aspiring writer that you know, any wisdom to impart?
Oh, yeah. I'll tell you, the first thing that I would say is don't tell anybody you're writing a novel. And the second thing I would say is make sure to tell everybody you're writing stories. Make sure to tell everybody your stories. And it almost sounds like an oxymoron. It almost sounds like I'm speaking out two sides of my mouth. But let me explain what I mean. While you're writing, if you tell people you're writing a novel, inevitably you get somebody who says, "Oh, let me read it." And if you let somebody read your work and they don't like it, and they say, "Well, you know, it's okay," then all of a sudden you're crushed. And that's a good reason to stop. There are thousands of good reasons to stop. And so I think aspiring writers owe it to themselves to finish first and then to sort of go with the thing that feels so good and to say, "Well, gee, I've written a novel," as opposed to "I'm writing a novel. I've written one." At least that way you're finished. You feel great about yourself. It's a tremendous accomplishment finishing a book. And everybody should be proud of that, regardless as to whether they get published or not. But don't tell people, because it. You know, listen, I know how I am. And what I think is that, gee, if I don't hear that the novel's the greatest thing since the Bible, you know, I'm crushed. And I'll tell you, I am so adamant about this bit of advice. Let me tell you what I did. I didn't tell my wife I was writing a novel, and so Mary would see me disappear into my office for long hours, and she'd ask me, like, "What are you doing?" I said, "Oh, I've got to catch up on some work from the office." And meanwhile, what she's thinking is that I'm like buried in internet porn of some kind, you know. So I'll never forget this day as long as I live. I remember one afternoon, it was like a Saturday, I think. I went downstairs. I worked out on our treadmill, and then went back to work afterwards. Didn't think anything of it. Well, while I was downstairs, what I didn't know is that my wife, Mary, had taken a flash drive to my computer, and she stole my novel. She ran off with it, didn't tell me. And so the next day, she's laughing in her room the whole time. This is top producer, laughing, and I thought she was on the phone with a friend of hers. I had no idea. But then, you know, I'm trying to work. I kind of forgot about it. And at dinner, we have two kids, and the four of us were sitting down, and we have spaghetti every Sunday night, and so we had this spaghetti meal, and the kids went off to do their homework, and I started to clean up with Mary, and she said, we need to talk. And I thought, oh, no. You know, she said, I have a confession to make. And I'm thinking, uh-oh, this is getting really bad. I have no idea. And she said, I stole your book. She copped to the heist. And I said, oh. And she said, I loved it. And so I was really fortunate because she gave me a lot of good encouragement and feedback, and that helped me finish it. But it could have gone the other way. And so advice number one is don't tell anybody. I didn't even tell my wife. But then try your stories out on everybody. And what I mean by that is aspiring writers should tell the stories or the anecdotes that work their way into the novels, or try out some expressions. Because when you talk with people, you hear it aloud, you see how people react to it. If you sort of think you have a great description of something and somebody is nonplussed by it, well, then you have real live feedback. It's like having your very own focus group. So I think that rather than saying I'm writing a novel, just try out your stories and see how people respond to them.
That's good advice. Are you working on a new novel now?
Oh, you bet. My third novel, I'm really excited about. I think it will scare charities across the United States. It will be terrifying to them. And it's really a story. You need a big theme to start with everything. So like in the Gods of Greenwich, I said, my big theme for the Gods of Greenwich is keeping up with the Joneses. What would you do to keep up with the Joneses if you run a hedge fund and your primary ambition in life is to join the glitterati of money management? That's a big picture theme. So in my third novel, as yet untitled, my theme is that some really bad guys venture into financial services, and they hide their bad deeds, some really horrific behavior, behind the protection of the First Amendment. Now, all of a sudden, that sounds like a big statement, and we're all trying to remember what the First Amendment is, because it cuts a really wide swath. But in this example, I'm talking about freedom of religion. And I guess I'll just leave it there until I get further along in the story.
Okay, people can look for that and down the road.
Yeah, it should be out in the summer of 2012. The kind of literature I'm interested in writing is something that keeps somebody company at the beach with their margarita.
Sure. Well, where can people find you online?
NorbVonnegut.com. Or just Google Norb Vonnegut, I'll come up. But come to my website and take a look. I put up stuff all the time. And you know what I really love, Jeff? I love it when people send me pictures of themselves holding a book, either Top Producer or The Gods of Greenwich. I put those up on my website all the time. So if your listeners are so inclined, shoot me an email and I'll put it up there.
Great. Well, again, we've been speaking with Norb Vonnegut, author of the new thriller, The Gods of Greenwich, which is available in bookstores now. Norb, thanks for doing the interview.
Oh, it's an honor to be here. Thank you so much, Jeff.
This is Lee Child, and I'm listening to the Reading and Writing Podcast.
Thanks for listening to my latest podcast. If you have a chance, please leave a review of the podcast in iTunes. It only takes a moment. Until next time, read some good books and be well. Welcome to the 55th episode of the Reading and Writing Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Rutherford. Stay tuned for my interview with Norb Vonnegut, author of the financial thrillers Top Producer and The Gods of Greenwich.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of plan investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.